because of the temptation to get caught up in the speed of events, because I think probably as many of us were preparing our remarks over the last week, they were immediately made irrelevant by the turn of news. One thing that we're going to try and do here today is step back to look at some of the larger moral issues, to look at some of the larger economic issues, put what's going on in context. But I'd want to just start us out, actually, partially because of our venue here, with some thoughts from CEOs of companies that are responding to what's happening in the news with immigration today. The Netflix chief executive, Reed Hastings, wrote on Facebook last week that that Trump's actions are hurting Netflix employees around the world and are so un-American it pains us all. Tim Cook said Apple would not exist without immigration. And of course, our CEO of Microsoft, our host here today, said, as an immigrant and as a CEO, I have both experienced and seen the positive impact that immigration has had on our country, on our company, and for the world. We will continue to advocate on this important topic. We are in a very fluid situation, and there's one element of this that I think Reason Magazine and Shika in particular has been returning to over and over, and that is how this is a very human issue, that there are people who got onto an airplane sometime last week and landed in a different legal landscape. There are people who thought that their green card meant one thing and discovered that it means something else. I guess, as the kids might say, that escalated quickly. And before we kick off, I just want to remind everyone that today is Fred Korematsu's birthday. So we are having a kind of moment to look at his legacy. He would have been, I think, 98 today, and of course was famous for challenging FDR's executive order 9066. And I'll leave you with a quote from him, which is, "I'll never forget my government treating me this way. I really hope that this will never happen to anyone again because of the way they look, or if they look like an enemy of our country. Don't be afraid to speak up. One person can make a difference, even if it takes 40 years." Take it away.
So I'm Tim Kaine with Hoover, have been at some different think tanks, and have been studying this issue for a long time, debated the issue with some friends here in the audience. I noticed we're assembled at the end of January. It's that time of month where by now you should know it's 2017, not 2016 when you're writing your checks, right? It's a funny time of year. It's the month is old, but the year is new. And it's a lot like the Trump administration. It's the end of the beginning. So we're past promises and concepts, and we're seeing actions being taken. I think more actions will be taken. Some are very surprising. But I think what I want to address in my remarks, and I think you're absolutely right, Catherine, it was very easy to get distracted because we almost have an hourly update on what's happening. I certainly want to focus on the economics of immigration, but I think when we put this in the context of what's happened in the past with immigration reform, but also with this presidency, because there have been a lot of actions taken, but there have been actions not taken, and I think those are almost as interesting. The 4% growth promise is one where I think the President Trump and his administration is already moving in the right direction on a lot of areas. Tax reform, regulatory reform are probably the most important. But when they put together an overall agenda, I think what we want to do, or I think I understand the panel, is to try to emphasize that immigration reform will be essential to hit that 4% growth target, because without immigration, you're not going to get faster economic growth. Now, a quick review. I'm an economist, so I'm going to probably defer to numbers instead of emotions as often as I can. When we look at economic growth rates, we haven't hit for a presidential term an average growth rate above 3% for almost 20 years. The end of the Clinton administration, that second term, barely got over 4%. But you go back to the 60s, you have, the Truman administration before the 60s, you had about a 5.5% growth rate. Kennedy and Johnson were both over 5% growth rates. Depending on how much you want to lag variables, the second Reagan administration had an extraordinarily fast growth rate that also topped 5%. But it's been pretty weak lately. In this last quarter, we're long into a recovery period. This last quarter, the news came out that we had a 1.9% average growth rate or annualized growth rate. So we're not nearly hitting the stride that Americans are used to or that we should. And I think, I've debated this, radio, TV, wherever, I think this is a policy issue, that a lot of economic policies are getting in the way and holding the economy back. Immigration policy is, of course, one of those. So Nicholas Kaldor published a paper in 1961 establishing six stylized facts that became famous within the econ profession. A half century later, Stanford economists Charles Jones and Paul Romer, both I consider friends, published an updated list of new Kaldor facts. And what's interesting is that the original facts were about tangible inputs, things like capital and labor and the ratios they had to growth rates. The new Kaldor facts are about intangibles, scale of markets, long-term accelerations, huge international variations in growth rates and maybe why they're happening, and one of the hottest areas of study in recent decades, human capital. Immigration, of course, is an important and a special kind of human capital. Now, the great insight of growth economics in the late 20th century is that the vast bulk of measured growth doesn't come from measured increases in capital or measured increases in labor. It's from intangible things. And we think we have a pretty good handle as economists on those intangible things. They're institutions, property rights, patent rights, immigration rights, free trade. So my three decades of formal study helped me understand there are three different kinds of growth. I write about this in a book called Balance, I just co-authored with Glenn Hubbard a few years ago. The three different kinds of growth are, one, innovative growth, which some call technology and others simply call ideas. It's the easiest to explain. You build a better plow, you increase your farm yields. This type of growth is associated with Joseph Schumpeter in his paradigm of creative destruction. The second type of growth is what you might just call investment growth, Solovian named after Robert Solow. The more you invest, the more factories that you build, the faster your economy grows. Now, what's interesting about that is that when we've done international studies on growth rates and investment rates, they're highly correlated. But it turns out investment doesn't come first and then economic growth. You find countries that are growing fast, and that's where the investors flock. That tells us it's an institutional story that the countries that have good property rights, for example, will attract greater investment. The third type of growth is commercial expansion, associated with Adam Smith. A resulting special of labor is known as Smithian growth. Now, each of these pillars, technology, investment, and scale, are founded on something even more basic. Some call it culture. As I mentioned, we call it institutions or economic freedom. For example, you can't get a lot of juice from scale-based growth without increasing the size and ease of trade. Restricting free trade is a surefire way to slow down GDP potential. As for technology proper, it stands as a key pillar, but invention without innovation leads nowhere. A classic example is ancient China, where they invented gunpowder, they invented the printing press, they invented paper, for goodness sakes, but they didn't accrue the benefits of those because there weren't really strong market incentives to commercialize those as innovations. That happened more in Europe, and there's no country in the world better at capitalizing on ideas than the United States today. So, to make sure I stay on time, the punchline is this. It's not about just bringing in raw labor, people to mow our lawns. It's about bringing in a special kind of risk taker, and that's what an immigrant is, who will fuel commercialization of technologies. So you look at Silicon Valley and who's founding the companies in Silicon Valley, an outsized number of immigrants who are risk takers by nature. Turns out entrepreneurship is so important as an institutional variable that when we now can look at companies by their age, not just by their size, right? So you've heard that small companies create a lot of jobs and are responsible for a lot of growth. That really hasn't been backed up in the research. But research data shows that young companies, startup companies, are responsible for most of the new innovations and 100% of the net new jobs created every year. Well, let me repeat that. I can look at every company that was created from 2015 back to time began and they kept records. Okay? They created a net negative amount of jobs. Older companies are in the business of being more productive and shedding workers. New jobs are created by startups. This has been a shocking fact. It's something I've written about. It's been widely cited, but I still tell economists this, and they're surprised because the data is not that old. We just found this out. So if you want more jobs and you want more GDP growth, you need more entrepreneurship. That's settled. Where are we going to get entrepreneurs? I think, unfortunately, the institutional incentives right now are against risk-taking. Just stay in your stable job with your pension. But there's one group of Americans that are particularly risk-loving, and those are immigrants. So right now, we know that immigrants create, on average, twice as many jobs, or are twice as likely to create a job than a native-born American. And I don't think we're going to fix that with our education system at the snap of a finger. But if we're open to immigrants from every country in the world, we're going to see more innovation and more invention. You want proof? Look at the Nobel Prizes this year. The United States received, or I should say, six individuals who are United States citizens received Nobel Prizes. All six were foreign-born immigrants to the United States. So, you know, 40% of the Nobel Prizes won in the United States are to foreign-born immigrants. So these are part of our community. The million lawful permanent residents that come in every year are lifeblood to our economy. So if we want to hit 4%, and dare I say 5%, we can do it, but we need to look at the key non-tangible variables and those intangible qualities like entrepreneurship that are key. So let's talk about Donald Trump really quickly in the context for reform. I've been fighting for comprehensive immigration reform for over a decade, and I've been stymied by the political system. And I've come to realize that it's basically us against the politicians. All right? So it's not just hard right conservatives that don't like immigration reform. There are people on the hard left that don't like immigration reform. They'd rather keep fighting and calling each other racists or security risk or whatnot. So I think we need to stick to the facts and try to pull immigration reform with someone who's willing to take action. Now, we have that individual in Donald Trump. He's willing to take action. The reason I have hope is, what are the things he didn't do with his initial executive orders? He didn't rescind the Dreamers executive action taken by President Obama. There's still a lot of juice that this administration wants to squeeze in a compromise to make Dreamers permanent, because right now the DACA and DAPA are three-year temporary programs for individuals that came to the United States without documentation, illegal aliens, whatever you want to call them. The compromise is not to create a citizenship free pass, and it's not mass deportations, it's legal work status. I think this administration's open to that. And the fact they didn't act to immediately rescind that order, to me, shows there's a glaring window of opportunity for reform. And it would be wise for, I think, everyone to get behind that instead of falling immediately into our camps and calling each other names. I was concerned, and I remain concerned. My wife is a green card holder. I'm going to be urging her to maybe get her citizenship soon. That's the danger, right? This climate of fear is not good. But I think this is more a story of poor execution and poor vetting by the administration rather than ill intent. And I'm going to have to keep believing that. The one indicator I'll look for, which is when we've got an administration that really doesn't want to move forward, is what do they do with the number of legal permanent residents that they allow in? Because we've been at an average of over a million a year for two administrations, 16 years. I think that's been great for the economy. I'll argue with anybody that it hurts the economy, because I don't think it does. And if the Trump administration starts to pull that number down, then I think they're going to have immediate problems with their economic growth agenda, and that will come back in the re-election, but also in the debate leading up to the re-election. So I'm hopeful. I'm going to be as hopeful as I can for as long as I can. And thanks again for letting me join the conversation.
It's 10 days into this administration, and I don't know about you, but I'm already sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm sadly not as optimistic as Tim is. I think the ill intent is there, and it's going to continue until it faces stronger resistance than it has so far. But in my presentation, I'm going to step back from what has happened in the last few days and look at some of the broader principles, why we should be open to free migration. And I'll look at several of them. One is free markets. In general, in America, we say we should let free markets function. At least in West, there's a very strong reason not to. Another is just freedom more generally, going beyond economic freedom to other kinds of personal liberty. A third is the principle of color blindness and how that applies to immigration policy. And then finally, at the end, I'll talk briefly about a few standard objections to having a presumption of immigration rights of open borders, and I'll try to explain why those objections, while not completely insubstantial, are not as weighty as they're sometimes seen to be. So first things first, free markets. Immigration restrictions are probably the greatest government intervention that we have in the American economy. They prevent literally millions of people from coming, finding work, participating in various kinds of economic transactions. Tim just mentioned some of the potential benefits that are lost through that. I would also mention that economists estimate that if we had free migration throughout the world, that would probably close to double world GDP. You didn't mishear, it would double world GDP. No other form of economic policy change that we could make has anything like that magnitude of benefits that can be expected over just a few years. And of course, many free market advocates, particularly people on the right, spend a lot of time opposing lesser government interventions that have much less effect than this one. And obviously, much less effect on in terms of the numbers of people involved as well. But it's not just a matter of GDP or dollars and cents or economic freedom. Freedom more generally is at stake here as well. We all saw over the last couple of days how, because of this executive order that was just issued, we're stopping and turning back refugees that are fleeing all sorts of oppression by radical Islamists like ISIS, by tyrannical regimes like in Iran, and so forth. This is just one small part of the way in which immigration allows people to escape oppression of many different kinds. In my case, the oppression of the Soviet Union. In the case of immigrants from other parts of the world, many other different sorts of tyranny. So I think this aspect of the way immigration promotes freedom is pretty obvious. Less well known is how it promotes freedom for native-born citizens as well. We saw, as was already mentioned, for example, the protests by industry executives in the high-tech industry and others were to protest by Americans whose relatives are now trapped abroad or in some cases can't move abroad. So you see that when you restrict immigration, you also restrict the freedom of native-born Americans who want to interact with those immigrants, sometimes through economic transactions, sometimes through personal and cultural ones. Sheikha, I think, in her presentation is going to talk about some of the other ways in which immigration restrictions impact negatively the freedom of native-born citizens, as well as the immigrants themselves. We also see this, I think, in the sanctuary city movement, which is also under attack by the administration. These sanctuary cities exist because most of the people in our largest cities, where a high proportion of undocumented immigrants are, they want these people there. They want to interact with them because they contribute to the economy, they contribute to culture, and so forth. So this should not be a matter of immigrants versus natives. Rather, reducing immigration restrictions can promote freedom for both native-born Americans and for immigrants alike. That is how we can actually make America great again, as opposed to through repression of immigrants, which will negatively impact both the immigrants and the natives. Now, I think it's also worth talking about another American principle shared by many people, both right and left, the idea of color blindness. Most people would agree either that in government policy we should completely forbid racial and ethnic discrimination, or at the very least we should have a strong presumption against it. Now, why do we feel that way? Well, one big reason is because race and ethnicity are morally irrelevant characteristics and ones that you can't change. Whether you're Black or Hispanic or French or Russian, that's not something you can control. It's something that you were born with, and in and of itself, it doesn't say anything morally significant about you. It doesn't tell whether you're a good or bad person. It doesn't tell how much freedom you should have, and so forth. What is true of race and ethnicity is also true of where you were born, on what side of a line on the map. Whether you were born in Mexico or in the US or in China or Iran or Somalia or whatnot, it's not something you can control. We none of us choose our parents. And it's not something that tells anything about whether you're a good person, how much freedom you should have, and so forth. So if we're against, at least as a presumptive matter, racial and ethnic discrimination, we should also be against discrimination based on place of birth. And of course, most, if not all, of our immigration restrictions discriminate in precisely that way. They discriminate based on our choice of parents. If racial discrimination is wrong, discrimination on the basis of place of birth is also wrong, at least as a presumptive matter. Maybe there are extreme circumstances where racial discrimination or ethnic discrimination or discrimination based on where you're born, where they might be the only way to achieve some great good. But at least as a presumptive matter, there should be a strong presumption against them because the principle is the same. Now, to be sure, where you're born may correlate with some characteristics that matter. It may correlate with the types of cultural values you have, or even in some cases, with propensity towards violence. But of course, the same thing is true of race or ethnicity. Some racial or ethnic groups have higher crime rates than others. That doesn't mean that we can impose draconian restrictions on the freedom of the racial or ethnic group as a whole. And the same thing applies to groups that are defined based where they were on where they're born. And I would also note that our immigration policy, as practiced not just under the Trump administration, but also under previous administrations, such as the Obama administration, it actually directly promotes racial discrimination, not just against immigrants, but also against natives. The Obama Department of Homeland Security a couple years ago concluded that we must continue to engage in racial profiling for purpose of immigration enforcement in all so-called border areas, which in practice encompass a very large fraction of the United States, where something like 40 or 50% of the population lives. And that means continued racial profiling and discrimination, not just with respect to immigrants, but with respect even to native-born Americans who happen to look like them, particularly people who look like they might be Hispanic or Asian. So not only are immigration restrictions themselves analogous to racial and ethnic discrimination, but they in fact directly promote actual racial and ethnic discrimination. Both liberals and conservatives who claim that we should be, at least as a presumptive matter, colorblind public policy, they need to think about this more and focus on this issue. This is by far the biggest area where the federal government not only engages in racial discrimination, but does so openly, even under the Obama administration, which otherwise claimed to be opposed to racial profiling in law enforcement. Now, of course, I recognize that there are a variety of potential objections to open borders immigration, and I think some of them have some merit, but in general can be handled by means short of the kind of massive, large-scale immigration restrictions we have now. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I will note just a couple of ones that are most common we put forward. One, the concern by many on the right, if we allow immigration or too much of it, we will increase welfare state spending. Empirically, this just isn't true. In the United States, states with high proportions of immigrants, both legal and illegal, do not have more welfare spending per capita than those that have fewer. Even if this were a problem, the way to deal with it is obvious: restrict the welfare spending rather than restrict the immigration. And there actually already was in place, like the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, which do that to a significant degree. Other objection, often cited by Donald Trump himself, is the way he kicked off his campaign, is the claim that immigration increases crime. The exact opposite is true. Far from Mexico sending us murderers and rapists, as you may have heard from the president when he was on the campaign trail, immigrants, including Mexican immigrants, actually have much lower violent crime rates than native-born Americans. They're actually lowering the crime rate rather than raising it. Another objection often raised is, if immigrants come in, they might negatively affect the rest of us. They might vote for bad policies of various kinds. I don't think this can be completely dismissed, but the data show that immigrants' political views are actually closer to those of natives than is often thought. Moreover, recent immigrants, for obvious reasons, usually have much lower levels of political participation and other political influence than natives do, so this risk at the very least is greatly overblown, and to the extent that it's real, it can be reduced, for example, by taking longer to give people citizenship, which means they won't be voting until a later period. Now, we've also, over the last couple of days, heard a lot about the supposed risk of terrorism created by immigrants. In actual fact, the annual chance that the average American will be killed by an immigrant terrorist of any kind, refugee or otherwise, Muslim or otherwise, that chance is several times lower than the chance that you will be killed by a lightning strike. So the risk here is extremely low. And by barring immigrants, we actually increase it more than reduce it. Among those who want us to bar Muslim immigrants are the leaders of ISIS. They know what I wish Donald Trump would learn, which is that if we keep out those immigrants, those refugees, that means more people living under the rule of ISIS, which strengthens them. And it also means less cooperation between people from those areas and American forces. And we see how among the people barred by the recent executive order are Iraqis and Syrians who have risked their lives to cooperate with US troops. That obviously creates risk going forward. Those people are less likely to cooperate with us in the future, so we're actually increasing the risk of terrorism rather than reducing it. Finally, I'd like to note the argument which says, well, it's perfectly moral for us to restrict immigration because you, in your own house, you're willing to, you have a right to keep people out of your house. You don't want to be there. So the entire nation, that's just like your house. We should be able to keep people out when we feel like it too. I think the problem with this analogy, which is often heard, is obvious. The entire nation is not like a house. If it were, then many deeply illiberal consequences would follow. If the government is like the owner of a house, for example, they could restrict speech or religion that they don't like. After all, in my house, I could keep out Democrats if I don't like them, or Republicans, or I could forbid practices of religion that I don't approve of, and so forth. So the government does not have the same kind of rights over all of us that a private owner has over a house. The analogy just doesn't work. So it is not my view that it is always wrong to restrict migration in all conceivable circumstances. There might be situations where it's the only way to prevent some even greater evil. It is my view, however, that as with racial discrimination or ethnic discrimination, there should be a strong presumption against restrictions on freedom of movement. And most of the justifications that are put forward for current immigration restrictions just don't even come close to cutting it, to meeting the kind of burden of proof that needs to be met before we can impose these kinds of restrictions on freedom. Thank you very much, and I look forward to discussion.
Thank you, Ilya. That was very good. And you know, so Tim pointed out the economic downside of a restrictionist policy, and Ilya pointed out the moral downside of a restrictionist policy, and I'm going to point out the liberty downside of a restrictionist policy. And, you know, in some ways, as Catherine was pointing out, even as, you know, I was preparing my remarks, they were getting overtaken by events. On the other hand, I think Donald Trump has perfectly set up the title of my talk today, which is Immigration Enforcement and the Leviathan State. It's almost as if he was giving a real-life demonstration of the remarks I'm just going to make. But, you know, just to begin from back in World War II, Nobel laureate F.A. Hayek wrote a book at that time in 1944, you know, just at the tail end of World War II, called The Road to Serfdom. And in this book, he very powerfully argued that when the government interferes with the peaceful, voluntary economic activity of individuals to achieve some collectivist end, central planning goal, it puts its country on the road to serfdom. It matters, he said, little whether these goals are socialistic goals or liberal goals or conservative goals. They have a certain logic to them. Because the fact of the matter is that if these restrictions leave individuals substantially worse off, they will find ways to circumvent them and subvert that goal. But the government's failure to achieve its ends will not be seen as evidence that there is something wrong with these ends, which are otherwise good and noble. It'll be seen that insufficient force was used to achieve these ends, which are otherwise desirable. Thus, an initial round of coercion will inevitably spawn further more draconian rounds of coercion, putting the country on a path to serfdom. This logic actually has played out many times in our country's history, and it is the logic, I would say, is working out right now on immigration. This logic didn't start now. It was put in place in 1930 when the government embraced its first major restrictionist laws that began working not with the natural mobility patterns of human beings, but actually against them. Now, in free countries such as America, other forces usually, such as political checks and balances, ordinary norms of human decency, the desire for stability, usually begin a backlash, a pushback, and prevent a full-blown serfdom or a police state from taking root. I think that's something that we are seeing happening in actually drug policy right now. The drug war is now yielding to a wave of liberalization at least some drugs. Trump has issued orders in his first week to start defunding sanctuary cities, build a wall, and this weekend banning Muslims from 7 countries, including even green card holders. This order itself is scary, but what's even more scary is the completely arbitrary way in which it was crafted and implemented without any care to limit or minimize the damage to real breathing human beings. Trump simply did not give a fig, it seems, about how many lives he upends and ruins. In fact, as Benjamin White's editor-in-chief of Lawfare noted, Trump's Muslim ban will, and this is a quote from him, will cause hardship and misery for tens or hundreds of thousands of people, because that is precisely what it is intended to do. It is malevolence whose only saving grace is its incompetence. And this is all before he even gets started on fulfilling his central campaign pledge on immigration, which is deporting millions of alleged criminal aliens. At this stage, I think one can't rule out a vast dragnet that won't just affect immigrants, but Americans as well, making a giant leap toward serfdom. But first, let's back up a bit and review where we are and how we got here. Since the 1930s, America has always allowed, officially, fewer immigrants into the country than the demand for them. The problem of undocumented aliens, a really, really tiny issue that has taken an outsized importance in this country's consciousness, is a direct consequence of the fact that America ended the Barcero guest worker program with Mexico in 1965 in response to labor pressure, actually, and did not replace it with a usable guest worker visa program that could meet America's demand for unskilled labor. Reagan offered amnesty to millions of these aliens, but failed to stanch the future flow of illegals because he too did not create a guest worker program. This was actually regarded as a great shortcoming of Reagan's amnesty bill. But after the Oklahoma City bombing, there was renewed hysteria against terrorism. And even though an American was the culprit then, immigrants became the target. President Clinton in 1996 signed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act that eliminated key defenses against deportation that subjected many more immigrants, including legal permanent residents, to detention and deportation for relatively minor nonviolent criminal convictions. But this draconian law was supposed to pave the way for real immigration reform to actually deal with low quotas and the irrationally onerous immigration process that's imposed, especially on unskilled immigrants. But after 9/11, all talk of immigration reform got upended by security concerns yet again, and the ruling classes doubled down even more on enforcement. And it is this mentality that Trump is taking to its logical conclusion, if the words logic and Trump can be really strung together in a single sentence. But also, I recall during the latter term of the Clinton administration, and I've been writing about this issue for a long time, and Stuart and I worked together at that time a fair amount. Clinton, there was a clear desire among Republicans to pull back from the harsh laws they had passed and end the chronic abuse of immigrants by separating the immigration and naturalization service, that's what it was called at that time, INS, into two wings. The service wing that facilitates immigration and an enforcement wing that deals with violators so that not everyone applying for legal entry is regarded as a prospective criminal, which is really how people have been treated. But after 9/11, all that went out of the window. The Department of Homeland Security was created that conjoined with an iron lock both the enforcement and the service functions of immigration. All foreigners were now supposed to be treated as potential threats rather than assets. The two words criminal and alien got fixed in the public mind. And just as the notion of blacks as criminals triggered the massive expansion of the law and order state under Nixon, so it is with immigration. Except the big difference is that Nixon could hide behind a fig leaf of a rising crime wave. Immigrants, on the other hand, authorized and unauthorized, as Ilya mentioned, have far lower crime rates than the native-born. And immigrants were demonized as criminals even as the crime rate in the country was actually at that time declining. Gateway cities like El Paso and San Diego that have huge unauthorized populations are the safest that they have. They have the lowest violent crime rate. So with immigrants branded inherently as threats despite the evidence, the country took two big steps on the road to serfdom in the wake of 9/11. An excellent paper by Walter Ewing, Daniel Martinez, and Ruben Rumbart of the American Immigration Council point out that, one, the definition of who constitutes a criminal alien was vastly expanded, and two, a massive enforcement apparatus was created. So who constitutes a criminal alien today? Most people would think that it would be someone who has committed violent or at least serious crime. But if you examine the DHS's data, and they did an analysis of its 2013 deportation data, Ewing and all found that it shows that immigrants who committed what FBI defines as serious crimes such as assault, robbery, burglary, larceny, theft, collectively they only constitute about a fifth of the deported population. About 15% were removed for drug-related offenses such as small amounts of possession of marijuana or traffic violations such as unpaid tickets or non-fatal hit and runs. Nearly a third were removed for immigration-related offenses, illegal entry or repeat entry. The first is a misdemeanor in most circumstances, but the second has been now branded a felony actually for a while now. Indeed, now nearly all those sentenced for unlawful entry the second time receive a prison sentence, which is 2 years. So you go to jail for 2 years for illegally entering a second time. Equally tragic, the immigrants detained and deported don't even have to be illegal anymore. Many of them are legal and even permanent residents or green card holders thanks to the Clinton-era anti-terrorism laws. That law mandated that the detention and deportation of any non-citizen, including green card holders, who had been convicted of aggravated felonies and crimes of moral turpitude. And they expanded what counts as aggravated felonies for immigration purposes in a way that has no resemblance to regular criminal justice. For example, such things as simple battery, so you get into a fight in a bar, or some simple theft, filing a false tax return, and failing to appear in court are now all aggravated felonies under immigration law, but not normal criminal justice law. Post 9/11, thanks to this law, horror stories abound of green card holders with decades in the country handed over to immigration authorities for deportation for minor crimes such as minor domestic violence or DUIs or what have you. In other words, more and more immigrants are getting caught on the in the enforcement machinery for ever more minor offenses. President Obama is roundly criticized for deporting 2.5 million people on his watch, and he should be. But one reason that he had to take such a harsh approach was because Congress appropriated funds for deportation that he had to exhaust. In fact, Congress instructed ICE in 2009 to fill 34,000 detention beds every day. Every day they had to fill 34,000 detention beds. It was not possible for the Obama administration to do so only by focusing on hardened undocumented criminals, because immigrants just are not that crime prone. So the administration had to keep digging deeper into the alien pool using ever more frivolous grounds and using ever more inflated rhetoric to go along with its actions. The only way President Obama could have escaped the statutory shackles imposed on him was by prioritizing immigration reform, making it among his first orders of business, as many of us had actually begged him at the time. It was a sensitive issue, we told him, that required a lot of political capital that presidents only have initially, which Donald Trump, by the way, understands fully well. For all of his other incompetence, he understands the politics of this very, very well. President Obama failed to do so, and that was a missed opportunity, and that will be a huge taint on his legacy. But that's a story we'll discuss on another day. Toward the tail end of President Obama's term, he did begin to pull back from his expansive definition and started more targeted deportations under his priority enforcement program, mainly because he was running out of people to deport, not because of really any other reason. And that's why President Trump's pledge to deport millions more is so ominous at this stage. How will he find these people? Basically by widening the dragnet even further. The LA Times has reported that his senior advisors say he'll crack down on immigrants who've been charged but not convicted of crimes. In other words, they can book people on the flimsiest of grounds and send them to detention camps to be deported. Basically, every non-citizen might be fair game, legal, illegal, with temporary visas or green cards, just as with the Muslim ban. Trump will get away with this because detention is not considered imprisonment and deportation is not considered a criminal punishment. It is just considered a civil action. So he doesn't have to extend the same due process rights for such actions that he would have to for a criminal conviction and a jail sentence. And Trump will be aided in his efforts to snag immigrants by a giant enforcement apparatus erected over two decades. His two big tools will be a 287G program that was created by the 1996 Clinton era law. It basically allows local law enforcement to voluntarily sign up with DHS agents and acquire nearly the same powers as federal agents to access federal databases, check immigration status, interrogate and arrest non-citizens, and issue detainers till they are whisked away for deportation by ICE agents. It is the opposite of what sanctuary cities do. This is the tool that the notorious Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio used to unleash his reign of terror in his county. In fact, the National Sheriff's Association, always looking to expand its mission, has been asking for the expansion of this program, and it may well get it under President Trump. The other tool that President Bush created, President Obama mothballed in 2009, and President Trump announced last week he will restore, is the Secure Communities Program. This has received a lot of press. This program of questionable constitutionality requires law enforcement to check the fingerprints of anyone they detain, no matter how minor the crime, against ICE databases. If these folks turn out to be illegal, ICE issues a detainer requiring the person to be held for 48 hours till he's whisked away for the deportation. Basically, something as minor as unpaid parking tickets can become grounds for deportation, breaking families, ruining lives. Undocumented aliens simply don't have very much margin for error. This program actually triggered the sanctuary city movement around the country, forcing President Obama finally to replace it with something called the Priority Enforcement Program, which started prioritizing deportation based on the actual threat, but although that definition was also pretty loose. Also back on the Trump menu will be SWAT raids on workplaces, schools, etc., to hunt down undocumented workers. LA Times has also reported a story that's saying that these tactics are back under consideration by the senior Trump staff. Now, Trump may well make life a living hell for immigrants, but anyone who believes that this dragnet will leave Americans themselves unscathed is living in a fool's paradise, as Ilya pointed out. In 2014, 66% of the illegals who were deported had been in the country more than 10 years, long enough to put down roots and acquire families. In 2013, 5,100 American kids were in foster care because their parents had been deported. Many Americans in mixed status families have chosen to self-exile because one spouse is undocumented. So these are Americans who are self-exiling. Some opt to break up. Nearly 90% of the deported are men, leaving their American families, who lose a breadwinner, no option but to go on the welfare system. Indeed, our deportation policies are sowing the seeds for the next generation of a Hispanic underclass. But it is not just American Hispanics and minorities that are going to be affected by Trump's dragnet. Blue-blooded Americans will be too. Mandatory E-Verify will essentially mean that all Americans will have to get a permission slip from the government to work. At the local level, cities such as Riverside, New Jersey, that go after have been going after actually for a while, after American landlords that rent to undocumented aliens. In Alabama, they've started imposing business death penalties on any establishment caught for a second time hiring undocumented workers. Basically, they are shutting down American businesses to protect American jobs. The ACLU has pointed out that 66% of Americans already live in what amounts to a constitution-free zone. That's because, thanks to Interior Enforcement, Border Patrol's authority to conduct what they call routine searches, such as searching luggage or a vehicle, is no longer limited to the ports of entry, but it extends 100 miles inwards. in this region, border agents don't need a warrant or even suspicion of wrongdoing to stop people. They can stop anyone. Non-cooperation is dealt with very harshly. Stories of abuse of people whose face or manner triggers a border enforcement official are just legion. We actually did, Reason TV did a great video about this a few years ago. In this area that covers, this 100-mile constitution-free zone now covers full states of Maine, Florida, and much of Michigan where I actually live. DHS in these areas can institute roving patrols with broad extra constitutional powers. It can set up traffic checkpoints and fly surveillance drone overhead with high-powered cameras to track movements. The Nation actually did a great story two years ago about a town in Arizona, which is within this 100-mile zone, where border patrol checkpoints have become a permanent presence, and people can't go to the grocery store now without submitting themselves to an inspection first. It is like living in the West Bank. But there is still a lot of scope for President Trump to ramp up and scale up all of this. His inaugural speech painted a dystopic picture of America. If his first week is any indication, he might make it a reality exactly as Hayek had warned.
So talk to me a little bit from your kind of respective positions about why do you think that rhetoric has come about, and what does it mean for how this debate goes forward?
So I teach constitutional law, and it is a Muslim ban, albeit thinly veiled and disguised. You don't have to take my word for it. Take that of Rudy Giuliani, who at least says that he helped design this program. And he says, well, we wanted to do a Muslim ban, but we thought that would be problematic. Perhaps we would do it directly. So we wanted to get as close as we could to achieving the same thing by other means. And so they target, in this case, seven nations, all of which are overwhelmingly Muslim. Then there's a provision possibly providing favorable treatment for groups that are minority religions in those countries, which I think they had in mind non-Muslims, though you could potentially separate out different kinds of Muslims, Sunnis and Shia and so forth, who might be minorities. So in ordinary constitutional law, religious, ethnic, or racial discrimination is forbidden when it's explicit, if you explicitly say we're discriminating against Muslims, but also if on the face of your measure, it's on facially neutral, but in reality, it's intended to affect a particular religious or ethnic or racial group, that too is usually unconstitutional. For example, consider, for instance, poll taxes imposed on voting in the Jim Crow South. On its face, they were neutral, but we know they should have been struck down as unconstitutional because the intention was clearly to target blacks. However, in the immigration area, there is a wrinkle, the so-called plenary powers doctrine, which the Supreme Court has said often allows the government to take measures in the area of immigration, including various kinds of discrimination that would be forbidden in other areas. I think the plenary powers doctrine, while fairly well entrenched in a precedent, is badly wrong. I can talk about the legal issues there, but for our immediate purposes, the moral issues are also important, and that is even if for some technical legal reasoning, it's legal for the government to engage in this kind of religious discrimination, it's still morally wrong and unjust. And the fact that it's so that it's veiled as something that on its face is neutral should not blind us to what is clearly the ill intent here, admitted by the administration's own supporters and the people who helped draft this particular measure. It is aimed at Muslims, and the thin veneer of neutrality should not deceive us.
The only thing I'll add to that is that, just because not all Muslims are banned doesn't mean it's not a Muslim ban, because everybody who is banned is a Muslim. And in fact, he has said he'll make exceptions for Christian refugees. So, but, you know, to your point of the hashtag Muslim ban, I mean, to some extent, it's a great example of the, you know, the forces of pushback working however much Trump may have tried to fool people, the fact is that this is a Muslim ban. People recognized it very quickly and mounted something of a resistance movement, which, you know, we'll see if it works in this case. But even if it doesn't, it just shows you what the forces are out there. But to say that this is not a Muslim ban to me sounds pretty slim.
Without disagreeing with either of my colleagues, I think it's a distraction. I think this issue of fighting over this is really a distraction. And there have been many worse things in U.S. history. When I look back at the internment camps that were set up by the liberal hero Franklin Delano Roosevelt for U.S. citizens. That's really egregious. The president has a ton of discretion about which refugees are let in. President Obama had very low numbers of refugees from Afghanistan and from Syria until his last year, right? So President Trump wants to restructure that. I think it's been done very clumsily. I think there may be some merit to the constitutionality, but he has a ton of discretion. And there are a lot of refugees around the world, including in Central America, which we've been a little bit cold to in this country. All that said, the United States has been extremely generous with its acceptance of refugees. And overall, number one country in terms of accepting not just refugees, but permanent residents to become U.S. citizens. The number one country that does that is the United States. On a per capita basis, no, the Canadians are great. I think we're maybe number 11. But just in raw numbers, we have been a generous country. Also, if you look at American attitudes, you know, if we just worry about what's happening with what I think is a sideshow, the American people, if you ask, do you think immigrants of different races and different religions strengthened the country? I think the number is 55, maybe it's 60% in a Pew poll recently. That's double the most accepting attitudes in a European country, right? So we are a generous people. I wouldn't get too distracted by something that was very clumsily and poorly rolled out and get too worried about it.
I disagree a little bit. It wasn't just clumsy. It was intentionally done this way. Press reports indicate that DHS officials warned the White House that these kind of ill effects would happen. They chose to press ahead anyway because they don't care, or even perhaps they think with their core constituency it might be politically advantageous. Totally agree, the U.S. historically has been relatively generous, and the majority public attitudes are not where Trump is, but we should not ignore the fact that these people are in power, that they do have this ill intent, and that they need to be actively opposed, and it is not a sideshow to look at many thousands of people who are severely harmed by this and to say that that's wrong and should be reversed.
Yeah, and let me just reiterate, this wasn't the single thing that the Trump administration did in their first week. This was part of a series of executive orders, mm-hmm. all against immigration, building a wall, defunding sanctuary cities, what have you. So I think at this point we are entitled to make some presumption about the intent of this administration and where it's headed.
Like I said, I don't want to disagree with you, Guy. I think what you say has merit. But we can also look at statements coming out of the administration. This wasn't fully vetted by everyone in the administration and all the agencies, and there's pushback within. The restrictions on LPRs, I thought, was terrible. I mean, it made the administration look bad, but they had to walk it back and then tried to walk it forward again. So there's a knife fight going on right now within the administration, and I think, I don't want to get too distracted by this, I was more concerned about the fact that you had LPRs, who aren't refugees, right, LPRs restricted and turned back. That does affect our economy, and it creates, I think, a bit of a shockwave in, does someone who's an engineer coming out of a university in Germany or Turkey or India, would they want to come and accept a job at Microsoft after this action? That, to me, was I think the refugee thing will get flipped around and corrected. I'm a little bit more concerned about what happened with LPRs, and if like I said, I'm looking at LPR numbers in this next year, and if those are drawn down, that's where you get a real impact on the economy, and I think you really knock our status off as being a generous country in immigration. When you think about it, to tell someone who's an LPR they can't come to America, wait a minute, I am legal, I'm permanent, I'm a resident.
You're like, what was the additional adjective I needed there? Yeah. Okay, so I actually have a question about predictability or sort of uncertainty, and you alluded to that just now. Can you talk about sort of the economic impact in particular of what an immigration, you know, a change in immigration policy where even things like green cards no longer mean what people thought they meant or may not mean what people thought they meant? What is the impact in terms of economic growth of just the uncertainty
so
itself?
So if you are General Electric or Microsoft or a major, you know, tech or industrial firm and you're thinking about where to locate, right, trade actions that have been taken, that may be makes people think we should base our industrial operations in the United States. But if you're a tech firm and your production is ideas, I'm not so sure you want to deal with this uncertainty if you could base a tech center or a research center in England or in Ireland or in Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore. So I think this affects maybe the long-term growth rate and where innovations and inventions happen. That to me is this a blip? Is it a mistake? Or does it become policy action we see enforced for 2 years? You're going to see basing and job creation that will be offshored because of these sort of anti-immigrant actions.
Yeah, I'll just add to that, you know, the U.S. education system is such a draw that I think a single act may not completely nix its attractiveness. But I think the bigger problem is that a lot of students come over here. I mean, like, and you know, I took a traditional path from India, which is I came over here, got an H-1B, and then got a green card. The problem is, at least for Indian and Chinese immigrants right now, that there is such a green card backlog that, you know, you don't want to come and invest that kind of money over here in a U.S. education if you are not going to then be able to get a job here. So if you're just coming here for a limited amount of graduate studies or what have you, that'll be fine. But a lot of, you know, that's not the reason people pay big bucks out of pocket to come here. They consider it as an investment. And nowhere else in the world is an education as expensive as it is in the United States. So you expect big returns if you're going to come here. So it could have an impact, we'll see.
U.S. education is one of our crown jewels. And in fact, it's a big export industry. So when a student comes here to study and pays full tuition at University of Michigan or other fine Big Ten schools, that's money that comes into the United States and strengthens our economy. And it would be a shame to lose that crown jewel or to dent it. And I think the Bush administration was responsive. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on. And it has longer term consequences about work afterwards as well.
Does anyone on the panel have a sense of potential sort of moves in the direction of openness by Trump? I mean, obviously, we're sort of very focused right now on this the restriction on the seven countries and on the limitations on sanctuary cities and the building of the wall. All of those obviously move toward restrictionism. That's theoretically compatible with, say, increasing the number of H-1Bs. Does anyone who's...
So I think
can you talk about that at all?
Stuart is going to get into that, I think, in the next session. But, you know, that was kind of like the hope for a lot of us was that, okay, you know, if you want to build your stupid wall, go ahead and build it. It's like $17 billion. But, you know, so long as you start a guest worker program for
right.
unskilled workers, or if you, you know, ease the H-1B situation, that if you are using that to buy political capital, you know, to do that, it wouldn't have been an altogether horrible bargain. I mean, the symbolism of a wall still may remain odious and all of that. But I don't see the signs of it right now, and maybe Tim's optimism is more accurate than mine, but I don't see the signs of it.
I would just
right
second
now.
That, and I think looking at the congressional voting patterns and the way that congressmen vote, you know, or have answered survey responses, Republicans are so amenable to a legal status work visa sort of compromise. So you need the symbolism and being tough on immigration. But finally, you know, when the Obama administration with a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate didn't act, it felt like, okay, something has to change and we have a change agent. So yeah, it's willing to still put our bets on hope, I think, right now. Yeah.
Couple of thoughts on this. First, with regard to H-1B visas, this actually came up during the campaign several times,
yeah.
And Trump eventually shifted to a position not of expanding them, but
exactly.
reducing them.
Right.
And I think the events of the last 10 days so far suggest
right.
that we should take Trump both seriously and literally.
Right.
And so until strong political pressure pushes him away from this, we should expect at the very least that there won't be an expansion of H-1Bs, or at least that he won't support any such thing. He may even try to push for a reduction.
Yeah.
In terms of expanding, one area where he said maybe there might be some expansion is with respect to Christian refugees fleeing persecution in the Middle East, which indeed, obviously, they are facing horrible persecution in many places. However, so far, the order that he's issued actually works in the opposite direction. For instance, all Syrian refugees are banned indefinitely, including Christians, and reports that we can actually, there are examples of Christian families being turned back at airports. So while I do think this is aimed primarily at Muslims, and there probably are people in the administration who genuinely sympathize with Christian refugees. The dominant force that they're at least so far seem willing to let the Christian refugees be collateral damage of their efforts to get at the Muslims. Obviously, I think you're absolutely right. In Congress, among some congressional Republicans, there's different kinds of sentiments. In the past, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, members of Congress have not proven to have a lot of spine in resisting presidents of their own party. However, some Republicans have been very critical of what Trump did over the weekend. And if there is some hope, it's in that maybe some significant part of Trump's own party will not follow him in this awful direction. But as with all politicians, they tend to respond to incentives. So the stronger the resistance, the bigger the price Republicans pay for this, the more people will, more politicians at least, will be willing to stand up to the administration. There are a few who might do so as a matter of principle, like Justin Amash, for example, from Sheikha's own state. But most politicians aren't like that. Most politicians look to see where the political opportunities are and where the winds blow.
Do you think there's a possible upside of uncertainty there, that that because this sort of happened very quickly and because there have been ongoing clarifications and elucidations and to some extent backtracking, does that suggest that, you know, unlike a kind of elaborately vetted, process-oriented executive order or legislative action, that there's a greater chance of reversal here?
Well, I mean, that's what Ben Witt's, comment is. I mean, his hope is that they'll be so badly burnt by the incompetence of this executive order that they will, you know, they'll shy away from doing anything worse. You know, I mean, hope springs eternal, and, one can hope, but, I stay pessimistic partly for the reason, you know, look at his advisors. I mean, you have Jeff Sessions, who's the attorney general. He's an ARC nativist. I mean, I use that term advisedly, but he is. He basically crafted his immigration blueprint during the campaign. He has Steve Bannon as one of his core advisors, who is the head of Breitbart, or who founded Breitbart. So given these advisors, I mean, there are a few people actually in the administration who aren't bad on immigration. I mean, John Kelly, who's the head of Homeland Security, I think he has been in the past amenable to a guest worker program and thinks it's essential to stanch the future flow of illegals. But whether they are going to have any say in this administration, you know, it's really hard to tell.
Thank you very much. We'll reconvene in 5 minutes for the next panel.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, thanks.